Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
So let's welcome our teacher, Les. Do you have a title for your talk tonight, Les?
The title of tonight's talk is Right Attitude. Good evening.
Good evening.
When you, when we begin this practice and we start to explore what is the whole idea of Zen, what is Zen and what is Buddhism, a practice that is a bit different than anything we've ever encountered. It's not in the tradition of a Western culture. One of the things that we come across early in our exploration and in our readings are the Four Noble Truths that Buddha proclaimed when he had his great insight. And the fourth noble truth of Buddhism is known as the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path includes a right view, right aspiration, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And there have been numerous studies and numerous publications and books written about what each of those steps in the Eightfold Path mean. But if you look at them, you realize that they do not mention right attitude. The eight of them, when taken all together, constitute right attitude. So in our practice, it's always worth our while to consider what's the meaning of each one of these steps in the Eightfold Path. Because altogether, they sum up to right attitude. There is no specific mention of attitude in the Buddhist scriptures. At least I have never found something like that. No mention of the attitude that is needed to live in accordance with the Eightfold Path. Or in other words, in a more practical sense, we ask ourselves the question, what is the attitude that we should have in order to maintain our practice? In Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, the collection of Suzuki Roshi's lectures, there is a section on right attitude. And it's appropriate that the editors created such a section on right attitude, because right attitude is vital to our practice. Right attitude is the prerequisite for our sincere practice. Sincere practice. And in Zen mind, beginner's mind, that middle section includes Suzuki Roshi's talks on such things as the Bodhisattva way, sincerity, repetition, remaining calm, having no pride, having no gaining idea, leaving no traces, true authentic giving, and several more. And those are the qualities of a compassionate mind. Qualities that are reflected in the ways we strive to behave in our daily life. And the sum of these qualities add up to right attitude. And in a way, they become a guide for how we should be in the world, in our everyday life. How should we be in the world? We are guided by the Eightfold Path, which points us in the direction of our spiritual practice. As you become familiar with the practice, you realize that in Zen, in our practice, we emphasize that there's really, truly no such thing as right or wrong. Of course, this is a very different concept from the way we live and judge our daily lives, the way we make decisions. But in our practice, in our world, we say there is no right or wrong. No right or wrong in Buddha's world, the world of not judging and not discriminating. A view that sees the things of the world just as they are without inserting our own preferences. And this is a major part of our practice, to have that kind of mind, a mind where there is no judging or no discriminating. So in a very large sense, this teaching of no right or wrong is an enlightened worldview, is the enlightened worldview. And it represents a selfless attitude. A selfless attitude that includes tolerance, compassion, and patience. And right attitude also includes purpose, a sense of purpose or vision or direction of how we want our life to unfold in the most meaningful way. To have a clear purpose, to have a sense of purpose for our life is a vital dimension of our attitude. So even though we may say, oh, there's no right and no wrong, we should not compromise with our attitude. The foundation of our practice is the removal of the ending of suffering, and to live our life in such a way that we do not create suffering. And as Buddhists, we don't compromise with that. That is a fundamental part of our attitude. It is the fundamental point in our spiritual practice. No compromise. And traditional Zen teachers in Asia, where our practice evolved for 1,000 years, 2,000 years, the teachers in those Asian countries that grew this practice were very, very strict on this point, our attitude. And to give you just a short example, let me read something from the book Zen Bones, Zen Flesh. And there's a short story that's titled A Drop of Water. Let me just read it. A Zen master named Gisan asked a young student to bring him a pail of water so that he could cool his bath. The student brought the water, and after cooling the bath, threw onto the ground the little that was left over. "You dunce," the master scolded him. "Why didn't you give the rest of the water to the plants? What right have you to waste even a drop of water in this temple?" The young student attained enlightenment in that instant. He changed his name to Tikusui, which means a drop of water. In this story, the Zen master Gisan is really telling his student, you don't have the right attitude. You are carelessly throwing away water without giving it a second thought. Your attitude is not firm enough. And that rebuke from his teacher brought insight. And I imagine from that point on, he was very, very clear about his attitude. And if you were to read the biography of Suzuki Roshi in the book Crooked Cucumber, you will see that Suzuki Roshi's teacher, when he was a young man, his own teacher, So-on, was very hard with his students. In reading the description of how So-on related to his students, he was really tough. And he had this kind of attitude. He had this kind of approach. Watch your attitude. I don't imagine that So-on was somebody you would like to go out and have a cup of coffee with. He didn't seem to be a very friendly person. But Suzuki Roshi loved him for his strictness, even though he was very hard, because he knew that his teacher So-on was encouraging him to have the right attitude towards the things of his life, the things that he did and the way he behaved. And Suzuki Roshi recognized that it's our attitude that is so fundamental. You know, all of us come to this practice in the West, in America and in the West. We come to this practice because we have some feeling that we are off balance, that our life is off balance. Or we come because we have some question about our life and what it means. Or maybe we have a question, or we're confused about the true nature of things. So we come to this practice because we are not clear. We have some confusion. We have some concern about the way things appear and the way they relate. We have some questions about our relationships, or maybe about our own personal history. Or maybe we have some question simply about the way the whole world works or is supposed to work. In other words, we all come to this practice because we feel that our everyday life is limited in some way. And we come to this practice because it promises us, it hints to us, it gives us the feeling that there is something larger. And so we come to the practice because when we learn about it and study it just a little bit, we have the sense that it might resolve our concern and that it will satisfy our uncertain and bring us to balance. And then when that happens, when we say this practice, this is it, this will resolve all the doubts I have, all the troublesome thoughts I have, all the imbalance I'm perceiving, this practice is it. And we get excited by the prospects of being involved in this practice. So in those early days, we become involved, we become active, and we are very conscientious about our Zazen practice. Or in other words, our early attitude towards Zen practice when we find it is very often influenced by a sense of excitement. But if we become overwhelmed by that excitement, our practice will become ragged, not smooth. And we will little bit by little bit become lost. And we will be unable to continue paying attention. Which means it would be very difficult to continue right mindfulness and right concentration. And we may give up the practice prematurely without understanding why. So Suzuki Roshi warns us in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, there's one place where he says, Zen is not something to get excited about. Do not be too interested in Zen. He's really saying, in other words, when you come to this practice, come quietly, come with open eyes, or in other words, keep it cool, cool it. Don't get excited. Because in our excitement, if we come to the practice with excitement and we maintain that excitement, it's because we anticipate that we will get something from the practice. We're like a child at Christmas, anticipating that something wonderful is coming. If we have that kind of anticipation in our practice, for attaining something or being rewarded in some way, we will not be able to sit still in our body or our mind. So if our attitude includes excitement, we will not be able to feel the essence of our practice. And we will not be able to resolve our questions. We will not be able to express our own fundamental essence. We will not be able to recognize our own purpose, and we will not find the balance that we seek. And at the same time, if this excitement continues, discouragement will creep in to our practice, because whatever it was we anticipated did not come about. We get the feeling that after we're sitting for some time, our anticipation isn't paying off. We're not getting what we wanted. And our initial excitement is replaced by losing our interest and our motivation, and our practice becomes half-hearted. So part of right attitude includes being very careful about excitement and putting it aside when it appears. And sometimes we will notice in our practice that we go back and forth, our mind goes back and forth between enthusiasm and lethargy. Our practice is to notice this back and forth, this to notice our swinging mind. Which is a lack of firmness. And when we notice that our mind is swinging back and forth, we simply focus our attention and come back to the middle way, to quiet, to calmness, and the ordinary. We come back to the middle way to keep our direction, like a boat which is guided by a compass. You know, in these days, in the modern times of technology, if you are building a music system or a stereo system, and you buy the components for it, you will buy a stereo amplifier to tune into radio stations so you can hear the music. And the tuning of these stations is almost automatic because of digital tuning mechanisms. Your station is always, in a way, locked on. When you first get your new amplifier, you will select the station you want, turn to that number, set the number of the station, and press a button. And later, when you press that button, the number of that button, you will automatically be taken to that selected station. That's very simple. You get to the FM station you want by pushing a button. Don't even have to think about it. But in the previous generation of tuners, back in the day when technology was making so many handy changes to our music systems, we weren't able to press a button. If you wanted an FM station, you had to turn a dial by hand. And if you were lucky, your tuner would have a meter with the needle showing you if you have tuned in exactly to the station. And so in those older generations of FM tuners, we manually adjusted the tuning knob to bring the needle into the center. And in the less stable FM tuners, the needle would sometimes drift off center, right or left, and there would be distortion and a ragged sound. And so you would have to come back and tune the dial. But even before that, in even the earlier generation of radios, back when I was pretty young, there was no meters or no dials. We tuned into the station we wanted with our ears. If our ear detected distortion or raggedness, we would manually adjust the dial until we felt we had clear sound. Dialing the station perfectly was not automatic and was not helped by having meters to tell us if we were right on. We did it just through our ears and what we could sense. And that's the way it is with our practice. There are no meters or dials to help us know when we have the right attitude. But when we do find the right attitude, we have no distortion and everything becomes clear. So our practice is to notice when our mind or our attitude has become ragged, or when our attitude has shifted and when it has become out of tune. So in Zen practice, we have to adjust ourselves without the help of technology. We have to make the effort to center ourselves on the right attitude. An attitude that has no excitement, no ambition, and no pride. And an attitude that also includes not giving up and not becoming half-hearted. So, you know, we are not machines. There is no high-tech circuit in us to tune us automatically. We have to adjust ourselves constantly. We have to be aware of our own drifting, which is the same as keeping our eye on the needle. And when we notice we've drifted, we come back to the center. This is our attitude and this is our practice. And through this constant effort, with the mind of Zazen, we polish ourselves, we polish our mind, and our drifting will diminish. And this is the meaning of right attitude. Thank you. So, does anybody have any questions? Hi, Diane.
Hi, Les. Thank you. You talked about drifting. And I sometimes think my thinking could become distorted. I might think I have the right attitude, or that I'm using skillful means, or that I'm on course following the compass. And I hope that by sitting and practicing with sincerity, I can come back. But sometimes I think my thinking gets distorted, and how do we, maybe I'm not always aware of it. And do I need other people to sometimes let me know that? Or do I need to practice with other people so that they'll let me know that? I mean, I can't just be sitting alone in my house on my cushion. You know, we live in the world and we interact with other people. And how do we know when we've drifted? How do we know when we are drifting so we can get back on course?
Well, it can happen in two ways. One is just through your sitting, your quiet sitting, your quiet zazen, you may notice it. You may notice that your mind has drifted and your thinking has become a little bit off center. But like you said, the other way it happens is through your relationships with other people. You may be having a conversation with someone with a very confident feeling that you know exactly what you're talking about and that your message is right on. And your friend may say something that will stand you up. And you might feel, oh, I never thought of that point of view. Wow, I've been a bit off. So that's why we have such places as Kanando, so we can be with each other and learn from each other, pay attention to each other and support each other and feel supported by one another. It's our commitment to our friendship with each other that is important to help us stay on track. But of course, it all starts with our very silent and solitary zazen practice and trusting that practice, that our effort in that practice will give us a clue, will show us when we've drifted and we need to retune ourselves. Nice question, thank you.
I think Francis has a question, Les.
Oh, Francis, okay.
So when I feel I'm being authentic, when I say something and I believe I'm speaking the exact truth without any kind of hyperbole or bull, am I on track? When I feel I'm being completely authentic in whatever I'm saying, am I on track? Am I having the right?
Well, we have to be careful of being fooled by that feeling. It may feel nice. We may tell ourselves, oh, I'm so focused. This really feels good. When in reality, we may be off. So it's important to get beyond our own personal feelings. And that feeling that you just mentioned is part of excitement. You know, if we feel that we're being authentic, we say, oh boy, that's exciting. And really the needle is centered. So we have to drop off that excitement and just watch our mind very carefully and trust that we do have the capacity to notice, and we do have the capacity to return to ourselves when we must. So the best thing to do is simply rely on our own awareness of where we are and how the world is unfolding in front of us. And always be mindful. Always be mindful of judging things. But it is, your question is a very fundamental one to all of us that practice. And it seems like something that could slip away. What is my attitude? Is it the right attitude? Is my feeling a good one, or is it some kind of delusion? This, that could be very slippery. It just takes patience and some dedicated effort to polish the mind so that we recognize how we're doing. Thank you for your question.
I think Philip has a question.
Phil, hi Phil.
Thank you for your talk. Really lays out the field of practice for me. I was thinking of Francis's point that he brought up about, as I understood him, that when we're really feeling like we're kind of in the groove of practice understanding. What I related it to was it seems to me that when I'm sitting zazen, I can, and I'm feeling like it's sort of going well, that the I'm paying attention to my posture, I'm not spacing out, and my breathing is, my mind is within my breathing. Those are times when I'm least, my attitude is anyhow has slipped, and because as soon as I start to experience some pain or whatever, my practice will get ragged, and I realize that it's kind of an illusion, that this, and this is my experience of what I thought Francis was bringing up, is that my feeling of having right attitude, of having right practice was illusory. And it's almost a warning sign that something is missing here, or some kind of self-centeredness.
Yes, yeah. It's that kind of feeling is part of what we call pride. We get proud that we have good awareness. We're proud that we're not being distracted. and that's why, but you know, I think the best way to avoid that trap, the trap of pride and to feeling so good about our practice, is to make sure to look at what we're doing, to consider how we're practicing, and to make sure we have what the part of the Eightfold Path, right effort. Am I making my best effort despite any nice feeling that I have, or despite any pain that I have, or despite any impatience? Knowing that those things can come up, am I making the best possible effort that I can? And I think it boils down to that. It's very fundamental. You know, make the best effort we can at every moment. And if we can say to ourselves honestly that I'm not compromising with my effort, I'm doing the best I can right now with what I have, then we're on the right track. And I think even if there's some difficulty, that right effort will give us a lot of confidence to continue.
So mute. How about unmute?
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for your question, Phil. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, Les. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Good. Thank you for the talk. Thank you. It was helpful. I have a question about pain. physical pain, emotional pain, spiritual pain, how you tell them apart, maybe, and what you do with them. I've been having a lot of what appears to be physical pain.
Oh.
And I've tried to deal with it through the meditation, through attitude. And I honestly don't know quite what is the matter. And sometimes it's very bad, and sometimes it goes away. And I don't know what it means for my spiritual practice, and I don't know how to deal with it.
Well, there's so many causes of pain, you know, to the human body. And pain, can feel like a disability. We feel that this pain that I'm having is really preventing me from giving 100%. And so it seems like a disability, whether it's something in a headache or something in our back or our knee. We wish it would go away so that we could give 100%. But our attitude should be the best, the most constructive attitude we can have towards that is, this is not a disability. This is just where I am now. This is where my body is now. This is where my mind is now. I'm going to practice with where I am now. And so even though we try to relieve the pain with medicines or various treatments, and maybe it relieves and maybe it doesn't relieve, we come back to our practice and say, I'm going to do my best right now with what I have. My wife and I, we try to go for a walk every day to get some exercise, and frequently we see people in our neighborhood who are going for a walk, and they might have a cane or they might have a walker, and I look at them and I say, they're not letting that pain in their knee dissuade them from going for a walk. They're not letting the problem with their legs dissuade them from a walk. They're out there, they're doing the best they can in the situation that they are. And of course, it makes Mary and I feel fortunate that we can walk without assistance, but some people cannot. And some people, there are some things some people can't do without assistance, or maybe not even altogether. But the best way to be happy in this world is to do our best with whatever resources we have, without getting caught up in wishing that we had more. So just continue to do your best wherever you are, and continue to look for relief from whatever your pain is. Just continue your practice. And you'll find confidence in that continuation. Thank you. Stephen.
So you were talking about doing your best, and sometimes I have trouble of knowing when I've done the best I can. And you know what was, I know this is maybe something you addressed earlier, but knowing you've done your best, but also knowing that you not necessarily being satisfied, but more like saying, this is the best I can do, period. For example, let's say you talk about the cane. Someone's walking it, and that person could say, oh no, I could run this, but in reality, accepting the idea that they need this cane to keep going. But sometimes that's not as easy to judge. For example, how much work I put in or how much I do for my practice. So my question is like, how do we monitor that? How do we like, not quite necessarily measure it, but how do we, can we say to ourselves, we have done enough?
You know, as you continue your practice, your awareness, well, as we continue our practice, our awareness increases, it gets deeper, and we start to, and we can answer that question for ourselves. One day we may see ourselves and say, yesterday I thought I was giving it my best, but I can see now that I was holding something back. And you have that insight because you came to your cushion the following day. And tomorrow, when we come back to our cushion, we may see that yesterday I could have done a little bit more. Today I can do better because I learned something. So our practice is all about expanding our awareness and seeing into the true nature of things, and also to seeing into how we are living our lives and to seeing how our mind works and how we are influenced by things that distract us. So keep practicing, let your awareness widen, and you'll be able to answer that question for yourself day after day after day. And you find great confidence in that. Thank you.
Thank you, Les.
Ms. Phil.
If no one has a question right now, I wanted to talk a little bit more about sitting with, having trouble sitting with pain. And what is it Sandra was talking about, that when I was younger, I had the sense that learning to sit was learning to sit with pain, and that that was something that was valuable. And I don't know if I've just gotten lazier or what, but more recently, and I've had a knee surgery and arthritis in my knees, I've been less concerned about just sitting and enduring the pain, but trying to have a posture where I can do the rest of Zazen, the you know, putting strength in the heart area and sitting upright and focusing on those things that I like, very much in the vein of what you're saying, what I can do with my body, but not feeling like part of the practice is excuse me, finding a way of sitting with a lot of pain. And I, well, if you have, because I know it's valuable. If I'm sitting with other people, they can really, that can really encourage me to not be so fussy about pain. That there's a balance there that, anyhow, I feel like there's a difference in my practice from when I was in my 20s now, and I hope it's not just being less brave.
I think this whole question of pain, which is another way of saying discomfort, you know, we are so comfortable here in the Western world, in an advanced society like we have, we are so fortunate. We have, you know, technology has raised our standard of living, and we're quite comfortable in our lives for the most part, compared to the way people lived centuries ago, where they didn't have such comfort. So because we are used to comfort, any little pain is, we magnify it out of proportion. So we have to learn to live with the downside of our own comfort. It could spoil us. And I'm sure that the discomfort that we experience in Zazen turns a lot of people off to this practice because they want to go back to their life of comfort. So when we feel pain in our practice, it's not unusual, it's normal. It's the world we were born into. It's just that with our practice, we have to overcome the attachment to that comfort. And when the discomfort arises or the pain arises, we have to accept it as one of those things that occurs in our life and make our best effort. You know, it can be really hard to make a selfless effort when everything we do is very comfortable. It's a lot easier to make your best effort. It was a lot easier centuries ago when life was difficult. In order to find shelter or find food, we had to make a very hard effort. Now we just pick up, get on the internet and order a meal, you know? So we're a little bit privileged in that way. And that, for those of us that are serious about living an authentic life, that can become a roadblock. That can become a deterrent. So we have to watch out for ourselves and learn to adjust to discomfort and to pain. And that effort itself will show us something very valuable. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, do we have any announcements tonight? Oh, okay. Yes.
I'm sorry. So much airtime, but I wanted to mention once when a few years ago I was out sitting at Canando when I was visiting my mother, and I was used to having a lot of cushions to protect my knee with arthritis, and I sat next to Carolina, who is like a rock. She doesn't even move an eyelash as far as I can tell. And we were sitting quite close to each other. It was before COVID. And I could not, the bell rang and I couldn't get those cushions. And I had to sit for 40 minutes in pretty difficult pain. And I was able to do it because of her practice and my not wanting to embarrass myself. But with all those kind of head things going on, even so, the stability of her practice and encouraged me to make this effort. And I was really grateful for it at the end. I don't know if I wouldn't say if I could do it again, but it was wonderful. And of course, grateful that Kananda was there and there was this support of Sangha. Thank you.
Okay, but be aware that you can provide, you yourself can provide that same inspiration to somebody who sits next to you.